sit at my table.
Dignity.
Security.
Freedom.
Freedom.
Respect.
Justice.
Equality.
Equality.
Remedy. And protection.
Fairness.
Fair time.
Criticism.
Right.
Work.
Peace.
Losers.
Movement.
It's my mistake. Let me make it good. I raise the wall, and I will be the one to knock it down.
Asylum.
Identity.
Family.
Home.
Conscience.
Expression.
Expression. Expression, expression,
participation,
democracy,
welfare,
work,
leisure,
health,
education,
culture,
human rights,
charter dana,
solidarity,
responsibility.
Fill in the mortar. I raise the wall, and I'm the only one. I will be the one to knock it down.
Good afternoon to all of our listeners on CJTR Community Radio at 91.3 FM. And over the internet at cjtr.ca. We can also be heard on SaskTel Max at channel 806 and Access Communications Digital Service at channel 700. Wherever you are, welcome to Human Rights Radio, hosted weekly by Amnesty International volunteers, who are a worldwide movement of people dedicated to the promotion of human rights and the safety of all human beings. We're building a world in which every person enjoys the rights included in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other human rights standards. Our theme song is titled 30 Words, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, written and performed by REM and a collection of musicians from around the world. Today is the International Day in Support of Victims of Torture. And we're going to examine some examples of what is going on, talk about what Amnesty is doing, and what you can do to help stop torture in the world. Everything I'm presenting today is available on the internet at amnesty.ca or amnesty.org. I hope you can take the time to explore these sites to gain an appreciation for what Amnesty International is all about, and how everyone can help to support human rights for all people. I'm Jim Hutchings, and I'll be with you for the next hour. But first, we have a clip here from amnesty.org.
The story of Amnesty International began 50 years ago when two Portuguese students were jailed for simply making a toast to freedom. A young lawyer, Peter Benenson, was so angered, he decided to write a newspaper appeal. Thousands of people responded. Amnesty International was born. Supported and financed by people like you, we defend prisoners of conscience, the rights of refugees, campaign against the death penalty, fight torture, champion women, children and oppressed minorities. Together, we hold dictators and violent regimes to account. We believe in the power of ordinary people. You can make a difference.
We'll not be silenced, whether you're a Christian, whether you're a Muslim, whether you're an atheist.
We are peaceful and we're going to keep on protesting peacefully until our demands are met.
We're in a taxi. This man has a little child who was hit by a bullet in the head. And we were asked to take her to a hospital. There are no cars. There is no fuel.
We have researchers on the ground who collect evidence of human rights abuses around the world. With your money, we want to increase our presence where we're needed most.
Contar a população civil, quando ela feia dele, abriu o semeia, semeia, o agenda, الأمن المركزي كان في مدرعتين عليهم اثنين ضباط في 64 بالية في دماغي وستة في رقبتي وأربعة في صدري عيني الشبكية بتاعت عيني اليمين اتحرقت وجالي نزيف.
This is a doctor in Egypt who was participating in a protest in Egypt, and he was blinded and shot, and it follows. There's more stuff here.
Together, we can help save millions of lives destroyed by armed violence every year. With your help, we can stop some of the world's poorest people from being thrown out of their homes.
I was beaten, kicked, cursed, they spit on me, I was electrocuted. We witnessed brutality, severe violence against the people. For the Amnesty supporters, for all the people all over the world who showed sympathy and support to our case, I'm here thanking you very much.
Amnesty International, you have helped us to keep the light. We hope that you will be with us in the years to come.
And that was Aung San Suu Kyi from Myanmar.
To millions of children, families, and communities all over the world, in the hope that one day we won't be needed at all.
نستشهد نستشهد او نتصاب او نعتقل او نتعذب ده مش موجود الناس بقى فعلا ما عايزه تعيش عيشه كريمه فهنكمل ان شاء الله.
You can help us change the world we live in.
And that is kind of it in a nutshell about how you can make a difference. And I've got another video here that you might be interested in. I know I am. We'll just get it going here. It's, I believe, it's the Canadian citizen who was rendered to Syria and was tortured there. With the help of Canadian officials.
Two children can't erase the memories of the past.
I can see him from here.
I can still hear the screams of people who were being tortured in Syria. I can still hear it in my ears.
He spent 10 months last year in a Syrian jail, where he too was tortured.
I guess I'm fortunate because I could talk about my experience. What about them, you know?
Do you think about that often?
Right. Yes.
Right. No, that's
yes, I feel guilty if I don't speak about it.
It was late last year that a fragile Meher Erar returned home from Syria. Syria is a known abuser of human rights and certainly not a close ally of America. However, it was the Americans who sent him there. He'd been subject to one of the most secretive practices used by the United States in its war on terror. It's called rendition, when a suspect is picked up and without any legal process, rendered to another country.
My kids grew up in the past year and
I would like to thank my fellow Canadians who had contributed.
His lawyers are now suing the US government. They say America rendered him to Syria with the full knowledge he'd be tortured.
The United States had every reason to suspect it would happen, and actually our lawsuit goes further. It says that was their intention. Maher was rendered to Syria by the United States for the express purpose of interrogation under torture.
The extraordinary story of Maher Arar began in the northern summer of 2002. The IT specialist was on holiday with his family in Tunisia. He left early to fly back home to Canada. His flight went through JFK Airport in New York. While in transit, he was pulled aside by airport police.
I was first surprised because, you know, I had worked in the States before and I traveled back and forth many times without a problem. But I thought that it was a routine thing at the beginning, frankly.
It quickly became non-routine when the FBI turned up. For the next 2 days at the airport, he was interrogated and allowed little sleep.
I said, I need a lawyer, and they said, you're not an American citizen, so you're not entitled to a lawyer. And I asked them to make a phone call. They just ignored my request.
At the end of the second day, Arar was taken here, to a detention center in Brooklyn. He was finally told why he was being held. Authorities believed he was a member of Al-Qaeda.
And I was very devastated to learn that, and I mean, they did not mention any specific reason. They just said in that brief document, based on classified information we have, we believe that you are a member of Al-Qaeda.
It soon became clear that his captors were planning to send him to Syria. Arar was born in Syria, but only spent his childhood there. He left when he was 17 and never returned. He is now a Canadian citizen.
During the six-hour exhaustive interview, 2 days before they deported me, they kept asking me about why I don't want to go back to Syria. And I explained to them why. I said I was going to be tortured and I had not done my military service, and my mother's cousin was accused of being a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, and he was put in prison for 9 years. So I gave them many reasons, but they didn't seem to care about those reasons. I told them, I said, listen, you're going to send me to a country that you know has no law, they don't follow the law. And if you send me there, I'm going to be tortured. So I raised the torture issue many times.
Despite this, early in the morning on the 13th day of his detention, without any type of legal hearing at all, he was shackled and driven to a private airport somewhere in New Jersey. He was put on a small luxury jet, most likely a Gulfstream. On the plane, Arar was accompanied by a team of men in suits.
And who were the people who boarded the plane? Who did they work for?
I don't remember they had badges. They did not specify. I know there's some newspapers articles that they mention it's CIA, but I can't confirm or deny they were CIA, but I can confirm they were called the Special Removal Unit.
How do you know that?
I overheard them talking on the phone.
And they were calling themselves a Special
Removal? Special Removal Unit, yes. You have to understand the situation I was in. I was very desperate. I was disoriented. It was like a dream.
It must have been a surreal experience. As the plane headed towards the Middle East, a meal was served, and his captors settled in to watch a series of action movies.
They asked me, do you mind watching the movie? I said no, but you know, I was looking at the screen, but my mind is always thinking about what I'm gonna do once I arrive in Syria. How am I gonna avoid torture? Because I realized at that point they were sending me there to extract information. It was so clear.
It's coming in clear.
Are you clear to land?
Clear to land.
200.
Once the plane landed, Arar never saw his American captors again.
The first thing I thought about when I arrived in Syria, when they took me to a room alone, the first thing that they came to my mind is suicide. I said, if I had knife in my hand, I would have killed myself.
And was that because of the fear of what might happen
to you? Of course. That was the feeling in me. And I didn't know. I was crying all the time. I didn't know what was happening. I couldn't believe what was happening.
In a Syrian military intelligence jail, Arar was locked up in a narrow underground cell with no light. Beatings with a shredded black electrical cable 5 centimeters wide soon began.
The second day they started beating, the third day, that was, if I remember, that was the most intensive day of all. It was about 18 hours.
18 hours of interrogation?
Of interrogation. In between the interrogation sessions, they would put me in a room again for like an hour to hear other people being tortured. And
so what could you hear?
Oh, all kinds of voices of people being tortured. Most of those people, they used to cry, say, Allah, Allah, oh Allah, seeking the help of God. And it was very awful. One of the noise I heard is an interrogator apparently was hitting someone's heads on the metallic desk in that room. Bung, 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 like that. And that was very, very painful psychological torture, because I used to say to myself, you know, my God, I'm going to say anything just to stop torture. And they would basically put me back to the interrogation room, and they would beat me again like 3-4 times with the cable. And now they started beating me on my shoulder, on my back, on my hips, mostly. And they would ask questions again. Sometimes they would beat first and then ask second. And if you hesitated to, if I hesitated to answer, they would, I remember, sometimes before the end of that day, they basically wanted me to say that I have been to Afghanistan. And I said, yes, I have been to Afghanistan, just to stop the torture. And
was that true? Have you been to Afghanistan?
No, I have not been to Afghanistan. And I was
to flesh out his confession, Arar was asked which al-Qaeda camp he trained in. He didn't know the name of any, so he was given a list to choose from, which he did.
Let me tell you something that happened during the interrogation. I urinated myself twice during the interrogation. I don't know what that shows, but my nerves, like, I can't control myself. It's so scary when you hear people being tortured. It's so scary when you are beaten. And I would just say anything, anything they want, just to stop the torture.
Back home in Canada, Arar's wife, Monia Mazig, spent the first few weeks trying to establish exactly where her husband had been taken.
At the beginning, I was very, very kind of naive. I thought that my husband would be back very soon. And then more and more I realized that it's not the case. It's not as direct and as simple as I thought to be.
Monia Mazig began campaigning to have her husband released. Initially, there was little public sympathy.
A number of people were ready to assume that since he had been arrested by the United States under some sort of unspecified security risk, that he must be guilty of something.
A few months into his detention, Monia's campaign turned around when reports of her husband's torture were made in the Canadian press.
And I think at that point, people started to take an interest. People started to listen more to Monia Mazig. And it was around that time that Canadian officials themselves began working a little harder, I think, to get access to Meher Arar.
Meher Arar was finally released and returned to Canada 10 months after his arrest. By then, his case had become a huge media story. After spending several weeks recovering physically from his experience, Arar made the decision to tell his story in a press conference.
I had few hours to wait until my connecting flight to Montreal. This is why... This is when my nightmare began.
For nearly an hour, Arar described in minute detail what happened to him. So compelling was his story, TV stations disrupted normal programming to play it in full.
What I went through is just beyond human imagination. I know the only way I will ever be able to move on in my life and have a future is if I can find out why this happened to me. I want to know why this happened to me. My priority right now is to clear my name, get to the bottom of the case, and make sure this does not happen to any other Canadians in the future.
The government of the United States doesn't deny it sent Meher Arar to Syria. It says it did so because it had evidence suggesting a terrorist link. Arar's Canadian lawyer says this doesn't justify his rendition.
Regardless of what evidence they had against Mr. Arar, what happened to Mr. Arar is totally unacceptable. I mean, the fact that he was a Canadian citizen detained in the United States and was sent by the Americans to Syria to be tortured in order to extract information is deeply distressing.
The United States administration doesn't like talking publicly about the practice of rendition. Most of what's known comes from journalists, like the Washington Post's Dana Priest. She's spoken off the record with serving and former administration officials directly involved in the practice.
Well, one of the people we interviewed said, we don't kick the shit out of them. We have someone else do that.
According to the Post sources, it's generally low-level suspects who are rendered, and the purpose is either to get them off the streets or to get them to talk.
So one of the reasons that they render people to other countries is because those other countries can be more aggressive with them.
It's unknown exactly how many people have been rendered during the war on terror, but estimates run in the hundreds. Countries used include Syria, Egypt, Jordan and Morocco. Meher Arar is one of few to return. Australian Mamdou Habib is another case. Habib was rendered to an Egyptian prison by the United States. He was there for around 6 months and was allegedly severely tortured. He was then sent to Guantanamo Bay. To knowingly send someone to a country where they'll be tortured is a breach of international and US domestic law. According to Dana Priest, lawyers in the CIA, the Justice Department and the White House have developed a strategy to try and get around this.
The understanding is, the process is, that you have to get the country that you're about to render somebody to verbally say or sign a paper, I think it is verbal, that they pledge not to abuse the person. And once they have obtained that, I think that is done overseas by the CIA station chief. Once they obtain that assurance, they then cable that back to Washington, and that is their legal safeguard that makes this permissible.
So it's essentially just creating a degree of deniability.
Absolutely, it is. It's creating a degree of deniability, and there's a paper trail so that if it ever came up, they would be able to say, well, we got promises from country X that they would not abuse this person, and we have good relations with them, and so we take their word.
In the case of Meher Arar, it's been revealed that the US did seek assurance from Syria that he would not be maltreated.
That was an assurance from a country which the United States documents practices torture. It's also a country that's... there's seven countries that the United States recognizes as state sponsors of terrorism. Syria is one of them. So how can you accept assurances from a country with that sort of a background? I mean, that's a complete nonsense.
To suggest in the face of what we now know about rendition that the Americans had any other intent other than to send Mr. Arar to Syria to be subjected to interrogations and torture in order to extract information from him is completely naive. That was clearly what they were warned to do, because there's no other reason. Why would the Americans not respect his Canadian passport when he clearly stated that he wanted to go back to Canada? And he traveled on a Canadian passport. He didn't even have a valid Syrian passport. He hadn't been back to Syria in years and had absolutely no connection to Syria. So to suggest that there was any motivation other than to send him to be tortured is absurd in my view.
Meher Arar has always maintained his complete innocence of any terrorist-related activity. From the moment he returned to Canada, he pressed for a public inquiry. He doesn't just blame the American government for what happened to him. He believes his own government was complicit.
What we know now is they exchange information with the United States. They used actually to neither confirm or deny, but now it's confirmed that they exchange information with the United States, at least during the time I was detained there. We know they had meetings with the Syrian military intelligence. We know there was communication between Syria and Canada during the time I was detained there.
Arar's return to Canada sparked a heated debate in the Canadian Parliament. The opposition demanded to know what role Canadian officials had in the arrest and deportation of Meher Arar.
There is a Canadian role in this. Will the Prime Minister call the public inquiry so we can know what they did or did not do in order to prevent Mr. Meher Arar from becoming the object of this so-called rendition, or as I called it yesterday, contracting out of torture? Shame on Canada for...
The Honourable Minister of Foreign Affairs.
The government, though, put the blame squarely at the feet of the Americans.
Just another fishing expedition. The people who are responsible for the deportation of this gentleman to Syria is the government of the United States, not the government of Canada. Understand the opposition want to blame the government of Canada for the action of the Americans. This gentleman should have come to Canada, not to be sent to Syria, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Member for
Pictou. And we'll be right back after the break, and we'll continue this particular story about Meher Arar. This is about 10 years old, but if anything, things have gotten worse, not better.
According to journalist Kurt Petrovich, who covered the story intensively, it soon became clear that Canadian police and intelligence had at least some level of involvement in Arar's case.
It was becoming increasingly clear as some of the information was starting to leak out that Canadian agencies may have delivered some information to U.S. authorities that then enabled them to arrest Arar and send him to Syria, and that while in Syria, Mr. Arar may have been interrogated using Canadian information. It started to look really, really bad.
Arar's lawyers think that he came onto the Canadian intelligence radar when he had lunch back in 2001 with a man who was under surveillance. They think that this, plus another casual relationship Arar had with someone under suspicion, was enough for his name to end up on a terrorist watch list. Then, when the Arar family went on holiday to Tunisia, the Canadian police, the RCMP, mistakenly thought that Arar was fleeing Canada for good, so they notified the Americans.
And we think that that's when they panicked. The RCMP probably, at some point, sent his details to the United States, because Mr. Arar entered the U.S. several times in 2002 without incident. Then he went to Tunisia the end of June, beginning of July 2002. And when he came back from Tunisia after his summer vacation at the end of September, that's when he was arrested, detained, and sent to Syria.
In a country proud of its democratic traditions and respect for human rights, the Meher Arar case was creating shockwaves. In the middle of this growing debate in Canada, an extraordinary article appeared in the Ottawa Citizen. It claimed to have access to Meher Erar's intelligence file, with apparently damning evidence documenting his training with Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. However, Meher Erar recognised much of the information in the article as being precisely what he had falsely said in Syria under torture.
We don't know of any other sources of information about Mr. Erar being in Afghanistan other than that. And we also know, because we were told, that that the intelligence agencies were in Syria shortly after he was arrested. And we know from the Syrian ambassador that his entire file was given to Canada.
The leak to the newspaper was seen as an attempt to smear his name, and as yet another example of Canadian complicity in his ordeal. There was also a growing belief that the evidence against Meher Erar was decidedly shaky.
Based upon what I've seen, absolutely nothing. It's just based upon erroneous inferences and assumptions that proved ultimately to be incorrect. Now, obviously, I don't have access to all of the secret evidence, and we don't know what there is. But I would expect that by now the government has taken its best shot. I mean, they leaked, allegedly, his entire file to the Ottawa Citizen reporter Julie O'Neill, and she wrote an article disclosing what was in the file. And what we saw was nothing new from and different from what we already knew.
Finally, at the beginning of this year, the government relented to media pressure and announced a public inquiry.
I felt it was now the appropriate time to begin a public inquiry to get to the bottom of this.
The inquiry is specifically looking into the role of Canadian officials in the arrest, deportation and maltreatment of Meher Erar. It's been given extraordinary powers, access to all government documents and full subpoena powers. The heads of Canada's police and intelligence agencies are facing the unprecedented experience of public cross-examination.
Would you agree with me that there was a great deal of pressure coming from the United States in respect of Canada's response to 9/11?
I think that we put a significant amount of pressure on our own people to make sure that's
not the question, Deputy Commissioner. The question is, do you feel that there was a lot of pressure from the United States on Canada in respect of its response to 9/11?
It was clear that the United States was relying on us to do our part in terms of ensuring security of North America.
And in doing...
So far, the inquiry has only dealt with the context, not the specifics of the Erar case. Already, though, it's shedding light on how easy it apparently is for someone to get their name on the intelligence database, and how far this information can go.
That leads to my next question, and that is that you have an investigation going on, you have a target, and the target is John Smith. In the course of that investigation, you see Jim Jones talking to John Smith, or on the telephone with John Smith. Does Jim Jones become part of your security intelligence information system?
All major investigations will have people that will show up in that investigation from time to time, and ultimately may be found to be not involved.
Let's assume you haven't determined that he is the key player. He's a minor player because he speaks to John Smith periodically, not a lot. Question is, once again, is Jim Jones, his name, part of your security information data system?
It would be entered on the data system.
Staying with Jim Jones, somebody in a U.S. agency gives me a call in Toronto or wherever I am and says, listen, I've got a few questions about this guy, Jim Jones. Do you have anything on him? Would you share that information with the American agency?
We would share that information if there was a reason to share it.
Mr. Arar's case highlights the dangers of sharing information in the context of...
It's early days yet for the inquiry. There's still a year of hearings to go. Arar's supporters and legal team are satisfied that at last the Canadian government is allowing him a chance to get some answers for his disturbing and illegal treatment. Arar's lawyer in the US, who also represents the Australian victim of rendition, Mamdou Habib, says the Australian government should follow suit.
I think that's what really needs to happen in Mamdou's case is the Australian government really has to carry out an internal inquiry as to why this happened to one of their citizens in exactly the same way as Canada is doing with respect to Maher Arar.
While Maher Arar is looking forward to the truth coming out, his faith in the core Canadian values of justice and human rights has taken a beating. He's also paid a considerable personal price. A highly educated man, he's been unemployed since he came back from Syria. He still feels the psychological effects from his imprisonment. His hope now is for the world to learn the lessons of his experience.
I just wanted people to think again about the cost of this so-called war on terror that the Bush administration has been conducting since 9/11. Is there any price for human beings being tortured? I mean, no one denies that the world has changed after 9/11. No one denies that we need more security, but we should do it in a way that protects the honor and the rights of every human being. And that's the message I wanted to send to the world.
And of course, that's just part of the story of Maher Arar. And he went on, of course, to, I think, gain a sizable, well, significant, I think it was a settlement in the order of $1 million or something like that. But I'm sure that any of us would rather not have the experience than have the payout. A very minuscule amount of money, actually, when you consider what he went through. And then you have to ask yourself, was there a lesson learned there? And this was from about 10 years ago this actually happened. And judging by current events, one would have to say it doesn't seem as though the lesson has been learned by our governments at all. When we had a minister by the name of Vic Taves as Minister of Public Safety, Amnesty wrote a letter to Minister Taves and Mr. Richard Fadden, who was the director at the time of Canadian Security Intelligence Service. And the way they treated access to information requests. And I'll just read the letter to you. We're writing with respect to the ministerial direction. This ministerial direction to the Canadian Security Intelligence Service, information sharing with foreign entities that has recently become publicly available as a result of an access to information request pursued by media. We are urgently calling on Minister Taves to withdraw this ministerial direction as it violates Canada's international human rights obligations to prevent and not be complicit in or contribute to torture. Let me read that last sentence one more time. We're urgently calling on Minister Taves to withdraw this ministerial direction as it violates Canada's international human rights obligations to prevent and not be complicit in or contribute to torture. By way of letter to Mr. Fadden, dated 28th of July 2011, Minister Taves indicated that this ministerial direction replaces a previous directive from 2009 dealing with information sharing with foreign agencies. It also replaces guidance provided in Minister Tave's December 7, 2010 letter to Mr. Fadden. And they were written at February 9, 2012, and Amnesty expressed its concerns about the position taken in that letter. The December 7, 2010 letter had indicated that officials were working on a more comprehensive ministerial direction to guide CSIS international information sharing practices. In their February 9th letter, they urged that any such ministerial direction expressly incorporate a clear ban on CSIS making use of or sharing information that may have been obtained under torture. Unfortunately, now we see the new ministerial direction, it's evident that there is no such ban, and that it remains possible in exceptional circumstances, where there is a serious risk of loss of life, injury, or substantial damage or destruction of property, for CSIS to make use of information that may have been obtained under torture. And if you recall the video we were just listening to, the government at the time were taking information that was obtained when Maha Arar was being tortured in Syria, and they were presenting that as truth, as some kind of fact. So at any rate, for all of the reasons laid out in their earlier letter, they continue to call on the government to adapt a policy under which information will not be used if there are reasonable grounds to believe it has been obtained under torture. So there's two things there. First of all, it's certainly not ethical to be obtaining information in that way. And the other thing is, of course, you can't depend on it, apart from the fact that it should not happen that way. And I'm bouncing around here a little bit. I'm going to read some notes from other people who have survived tortures. This is more recent. This is from the this is actually 26, that's today, that this has been posted on the Amnesty site by a man by the name of Moses Akatugba from Nigeria. And it starts off, "What happened to your finger?" people ask me when they shake my hand and see my nails. What happened is that my fingernails and toenails were pulled out. The scars people see are the lasting marks that torture has left me with. When I wear sandals, seeing my toes reminds me of what I went through. Torture affects people in so many ways. It's inhuman. Heating cutlasses on a fire and then flogging a person's back is barbaric. It affects people mentally. It causes madness. They pass out because of the pain and admit to things they never did. What I went through, the torture and being on death row, affected me in so many ways. It affected my plans for life and my ambitions at school. I spent 10 years in jail. By now, I could have finished school and have started working. When I was released, I met old friends who are now working, now married, and I thought, I've been left behind. It affected my family. It brought them stigma, and my mother's business crumbled. The pain affected my mother's health. She developed high blood pressure and still suffers. What struck me most is that you can live in a country where you can face so much tragedy for no reason and yet still have to live there. I will always pray for change in Nigeria, but I advise others living here to be very careful so that they will not fall victim to what I went through. Join the fight against torture so that others will not go through such pain. For some, being on death row hardens their heart. But you must always look ahead and believe the change will come soon. That's why I'm very happy to join the campaign against torture anywhere in Nigeria and globally. Over 800,000 people signed the petition to free me through Amnesty's Stop Torture campaign. That support means everything to me. I've never met these people, but they used their time, money, energy, and I received thousands of letters and cards from them. I'm so grateful to Justine, the director of HRSDEF, Nigeria's Human Rights, Social Development, and Environmental Foundation, Amnesty youth groups, students, and volunteers. They are the reason I am free. They are my heroes. My message to torture survivors is this: join the fight against torture so that others will not go through such pain. If I have my way and can stop torture, I will be the happiest man on earth. I don't want any future generation to go through what I went through in that torture chamber. And that's a letter from Moses Akatugba of Nigeria. And here's another one from Juan E. Mendez. He's the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman, and Degrading Treatment or Punishment. More than once I begged my torturers to kill me. Years later I think about it and wonder if I really meant it. I think I did, at the time. I was tied up, nude, and blindfolded, and electrically prodded all over my body. Twice they pretended they were executing me by placing a gun to my head or in my mouth and clicking the trigger. To my abusers, who interrupted this torture with question after question, this was merely enhanced interrogation. That was decades ago in Argentina. But today, U.S. political figures, including presidential candidate Rick Perry, are using this same euphemism to describe the CIA's torture and ill-treatment during its secret detention operations from 2002 to 2008. And earlier this month, John Oliver's HBO show, Last Week Tonight, reported that of 14 declared U.S. presidential candidates, only four said they would keep an executive order put in place by President Barack Obama in his first days in office that seeks to ensure the U.S. does not commit torture. When U.S. media and political figures repeat the euphemism enhanced interrogation, they reframe the debate in a way that implicitly downplays the pain and inhumanity of torture. Instead, torture becomes a matter of rational decision-making and calibrated legality. We're getting close to the end of our time here now, and what I'd like to share with you at this point is some of the things that you can do. First of all, of course, you can join Amnesty, but that's not totally necessary. You don't have to join Amnesty to be a part of what we do. Personal letters make a difference, and we write letters all the time. Quite often, we're at the Atlantis Coffee Shop downtown here, and we meet on Tuesday nights at 7, and we have urgent actions. And of course, one of our main concerns always is torture. That's a major focus at the present time because we haven't seen enough improvement there. And there are a variety of people that you can write to. You can write to your MP, urging him to urge the Prime Minister to avoid torture, to make a difference in terms of the government's attitude towards torture. You can write ministers. Here is a letter that is proposed. You could just sign. We have letters that you could just sign that make those points. Here's a suggested letter to Minister of Foreign Affairs, Rob Nicholson, and it reads as follows. In 2006, the Conservative Party of Canada, the official opposition at the time, declared its support for the 2002 Optional Protocol to the Convention Against Torture, or OPCAT, as an important human rights treaty that strives to establish independent monitoring of detention facilities, and expressed concern that the government of the day had not signed or ratified OPCAT. Part of what OPCAT, an important human rights mechanism, is that it would also help protect Canadians detained abroad from torture. Almost 10 years later, and despite repeated promises to consider ratifying OPCAT, nothing has happened. Meanwhile, 73 countries, including many of Canada's closest allies, have signed on to the treaty. With the use of torture so prevalent around the world, Canada should be pushing other countries to become parties to the optional protocol as part of a wider effort to eradicate torture around the world. But how can that happen if Canada itself has not ratified? I urge you to work with your ministerial colleagues to set in motion a process to finally sign and ratify the optional protocol to the Convention Against Torture without further delay. So then you can sign that letter yourself, send it off to Rob Nicholson. Doesn't cost you any money. If you're sending a letter to your MP or to a minister or to the Prime Minister, you can send it without postage. It's hard to understand the government's attitude on this particular topic. And I think what we have to do is increase the conversation. If they don't perceive there to be any particular interest in a topic, they won't address it. If they think it's hurting them to be seen not to address an important topic, then perhaps they'll consider it. And this would be, I think, a wonderful issue to bring forward to your MP, your candidate. We're having an election in the fall. So make a point of asking your candidate, whether Green or NDP or Liberal or Conservative, ask them what their opinion is on the signing the optional protocol against torture. Let them know that you're concerned and you're interested. It makes a difference to you because it will make a difference to humanity around the world, not just in Canada. So we've reached the end of our time, and we'll close this week's Human Rights Radio on CJTR Community Radio, and we hope you've enjoyed listening to and have learned something new about human rights for all people. For information on past and upcoming shows with links to human rights actions and information, go to amnestysaskatchewan.ca. Peter Benenson, founder of Amnesty International, said, "Only when the last prisoner of conscience has been freed, the last torture chamber has been closed, the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights is a reality for the world's people, will our work be done."